Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For thousands of low-income Central Ohio residents, putting a roof overhead involves more than the usual burden. Higher rents, coupled with greater demand, hit Ohio's poorest households hardest. Of course, in a few weeks, the Columbus City Council wraps up a two-year study of its development incentives and how they can help or hurt the plight of those households. Joining us is Director of Planning, Preservation, and Development for the Ohio Housing Finance Agency, Kellen Craig. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And the Ohio State Associate Dean of Faculty Affairs in the College of Engineering and professor at the City and Regional Planning of City and Regional Planning at the Knowlton School of Architecture, Rachel Cleet. Welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Let's talk about, we want to really drill down into this, what we mean by affordable housing today. Rachel, it's more than rent, right?
Yes, it's also including utilities, all the costs that might be associated with housing. So it'll be utilities, rent. Some think that we should be counting transportation costs as part of that, too. But mostly for the calculation of affordable housing, it's the total housing cost.
And then things like how to get to goods and services.
Mm-hmm.
Proximity. Again, that transportation piece.
Right. Proximity to amenities, to healthcare, to your school. Plenty of other things as well.
You know, when we talk about, say, like we talk about those food deserts, and a lot of people don't get it. Like, how can being a couple miles away from a grocery store be that big of a burden? But it is, right?
Certainly, if you don't have access to public transportation, if you're not near a bus line or don't have access to a vehicle, getting 2 to 3 miles down the street to your grocery store can be a burden.
Yeah. Bringing home frozen foods, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The ice cream melts before you can get it
with your children.
Right. Right. Yes. Or if you're disabled in some way, all the more of a trouble. If you have a question or comment about affordable housing and what we mean by it today, we want you to give us a call. Tell us what you think, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what do we mean by affordable when we say rent? It should take up what percentage of your income?
Not just rent, but your total housing costs should be 30% of your monthly income, according to HUD, basically. And that's a number that was developed in the 30s, really, about how much that your housing costs should take up approximately 1 week of your monthly paycheck, 25%. And in the 1960s, it was raised to 30%. So that's the standard we tend to use. And it's for people. So that's the percent of your income. And we consider for affordability in terms of public subsidies. The highest limit is 80% of the area median income. So the 80% of the market area, that person would qualify for some sort of federal subsidy if there was a subsidy to be had.
Right, if there was a subsidy to be had. That's a big if.
Yeah, and in the state of Ohio, there are nearly 400,000 households that are considered severely cost burdened, which means that they pay more than 50% of their income. And so certainly a significant number of those 400,000 are right here in Central Ohio because of the growth we're experiencing.
And we're not talking about people who overextended themselves on a big fancy house up in Powell and don't have any furniture in the living room. We're talking about people who can't put food on the table.
Right.
That's right. They usually in house. There's a level of economic security that affects all parts of their lives, including the number of moves they might make in a year or every other year, their ability to put food on the table, their ability to pay their bills on time, if they have a college debt sometimes, and there's an education debt. So the ability to keep current on their debts is also very difficult in the situation.
You know, the Ohio Housing Finance Agency has started investing in programs to reduce infant mortality. And I thought that was a good jumping off point to talk about housing issues are about more than bricks and mortar.
Absolutely. So, Ohio has the, unfortunate distinction of being, ranked the third or fourth in the country in terms of the infant mortality rate. When we invest in tax credit developments across the state, we're looking at things like proximity to public transportation, proximity to health clinics, trying to incentivize our development partners to engage with community partners like Celebrate One, for instance, who's offering, programming programs for expectant mothers, fathers in the community to ensure that, folks that are living in these areas that have, you know, high rates of infant mortality, that we're starting to you know, tackle that head on.
You know, the most common, this was sort of shocking, although it shouldn't shock me after all this, the most common age of of people who are accessing Ohio's homelessness system was children under the age of one. That means that your biggest customers are our smallest and most vulnerable.
For sure. And, you know, Columbus is well positioned because we have the Community Shelter Board, one of the model continuums of care for the, you know, in the country. But that doesn't mean that, you know, there's still a homeless problem. And there's certainly a growing issue with families with children. So in Columbus, for instance, we prioritize funding for permanent supportive housing developments. In our most recent tax credit round in May, we announced awards. Two developments were focused on transition age youth, Marshbrook Apartments, which is a community housing network development that has 40 units of permanent supportive housing, and Columbus Scholar House 3, which is for also transition age youth, but who are women with children who are going to school full time at Ohio State or, you know, other universities in Central Ohio.
At the college level, when you're teaching this, when you're studying it, do you think about it in terms of the children and the babies who are living in these places?
Yes, of course we do. I mean, yes, I mean, that's, I think maybe my students get tired of me saying it, but that housing affects so many parts of people's lives. And it's so one of the things I think that's important to remember is that housing serves multiple roles in our lives, right? So I think a lot of times we think about housing as an economic good or way to raise capital. And that's can be in conflict with housing as home or housing as access to opportunity or housing as a human right or housing as a land use, right? So these different paradigms are always in conflict. And so when I teach about housing to the planners and policy folks, I teach about that social impact piece, that it's more than the structure. It's about where the house is, what quality of the house, whether it's accessible, whether it's affordable. And the other thing I think is important to mention is that it's not only low-income people who are having these kinds of struggles. Certainly, they are having the biggest struggles, I would think. But I think there are lots of people who are just above that 80% of AMI who are also having a hard time making ends meet and getting housing, the quality of housing they want in the place they'd like to get it.
There's the issue of how much of growing neighborhoods as well and the role of housing in that, that it's not just about rows of houses. It's about rows of houses with accessibility to goods and services like we talked about. And if you don't have any more, if you don't have any income beyond what you pay for food and rent and housing costs, I should say, then you can't spend money locally. You're not able to support those other structures in your neighborhood.
Right. And your children can't, say, participate in the voluntary programs that your school might have to offer, right? Field trips, if you have to pay for soccer or whatever those things are. So the lack of income. So that's called shelter poverty. Actually, that's a term for it. Shelter poverty means that you pay so much for shelter that you can't pay for the other necessities like childcare, transportation, food. And the shelter poverty rate is actually a lot higher. It's hard to calculate because you have to calculate it based on the family size and where they live, et cetera. But it's much higher rate than the cost burden rate that we have because it goes much higher into the income structure.
When did we start to change about how we think about this? A lot of people think when we're talking about affordable housing, and maybe you have it in an academic sense, but think about affordable housing, they're immediately thinking, oh, Section 8, subsidized housing, this and that. And it's bigger than that. It includes that, but it's bigger. But when did we start to change how we think about all this?
Oh, my goodness. What a great question. I think there's a local change that's going on. I think some places have always thought about that. And I think locally we're coming to understand it. As we face the influx of a million people, possibly a million people by 2050, I think that public officials, the development community, Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission are really taking a look at what it means to grow. And I think that's forcing a lot of conversations that didn't otherwise exist. So I think it's in the face of the extraordinary growth that we're starting to think about it. I think that for Ohio, you know, we're a Central Ohio is a place where the private sector has a lot of influence and is very much engaged in what happens in the public life,
which is good.
Which is good. No, that's been called the what is that? That's the Columbus Way. It's in a case study. The
public
business private school.
Partnership.
Exactly.
Blah,
this
blah,
is all
blah,
good.
Blah.
And I think though that the recognition that say the workforce isn't going to be there. Or that the kind of segregation, economic segregation we have, don't necessarily translate into the kinds of vitality we want to have for the region, has been something we've learned over the past, I would say, well, since I've been here, so that would be like 5 years, I would believe. Mm-hmm. So in the rest of the country, there's certainly been efforts in other metropolitan areas locally to. Create other opportunities. So there are some places that have had housing levies for 20 years where they've been adding an extra tax to themselves and revoting every 7 years to tax themselves to support affordable housing locally. There have been other places that have had mandatory inclusionary zoning programs since the 1970s.
That means building a certain percentage of units for that include affordable housing.
That's right. That's okay. Right. Yes. If you build and you get to build more densely, and there are ways of compensating the developer for the additional cost of those units. There are places in the country that have had longstanding community land trusts. So this is not like it's widespread. And because we're not, because it's in particular places, right?
Uh-huh.
And there are particular places that have had a long conversation about what their community is and who's going to be in that community, who belongs there. And I think we've had the segregation we've had in Columbus has prevented that kind of community conversation. And I think with the creation of the Women's Commission, the most recent exploration around tax incentives or tax abatements for affordable housing, mm-hmm. the idea of creating a fund for affordable housing, those kinds of things are things that we need to be thinking about in this context, but it's not something that's new in the world, I would say.
I think we're learning a lot from, you know, the lessons learned in Austin, in Charlotte, in Nashville that have, you know, preceded
ridiculous
us in terms of their significant growth.
Toronto also.
Yeah. And I think in Columbus, they're starting to have a lot of conversation about, you know, the so-called missing middle, this, you know, band of incomes between 60% and 120% of AMI, where there's just not enough affordable housing. And I think that's where, you know, the work that the city's doing with their new incentive structure, you know, can really have an impact. Because without a multifaceted approach, you know, at OFO, we're focused on the 60% AMI and below, but we really need to target these other areas because if there's not housing available for this 60 to 120%, they're going to gobble up the stuff that's available right now
for
the folks that are lower income
yeah.
and get pushed further out. So it just has a rippling effect if we don't tackle this. You know,
We're going to talk about some of those development incentives that are being considered by the city coming up in a few minutes. If you have a question or comment, what are we talking about? We're talking about affordable housing. What does that mean? It's not necessarily Section 8 or subsidized. It can be all things, including middle-income people who can't afford to live in places in the city anymore. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about affordable housing in Columbus, what's working, what isn't, and how transportation figures into the equation. Still with us, OSU professor and of city and regional planning at the Knowlton School of Architecture, Rachel Cleet, also director of planning, preservation, and development for the Ohio Housing Finance Agency, Kellen Craig, and joining us now is treasurer of Transit Columbus, Mark Conti. Welcome back, everybody.
Thanks.
Mark, how does the availability and access to transportation, public or not, affect our housing costs?
Oh, it's certainly tremendous. I pulled some numbers from the Center for Neighborhood Technology in Chicago, and they estimate for the average person in Franklin County that 26% of their income is going towards housing, and then it's another 21% going towards transportation. And then you think about the type of transportation a lot of people have that are working poor or low income. It's not very reliable if they own a car. So there's a lot more repair costs. There could be one repair or a car break away from losing their job if they can't get to work that day.
And getting to work from anywhere to anywhere else in this region is very, very difficult because of the way it's constructed.
Yeah, yeah. And COTA has the Transit Authority has certainly done its part. Mm-hmm. They redesigned their transit system a little over a year ago, and they're doing a lot more high-frequency routes to a lot more jobs and a lot more residents. But we have a long way to go. If you were to compare us to, say, Portland, Oregon, you take a look at their growth policies. While they have a higher housing cost generally than we do here in Franklin County, at the same time, they've heavily invested in a robust transit system, including rail. So they have a lot more neighborhoods where you just don't even need a car and you can still get to work.
I read something interesting, and I think it was about Columbus, that there's a requirement that for every unit of multi-unit housing built, you have to have two parking spaces allocated for them. And that isn't really the reality for most people living in multi-unit housing.
And that just jacks up the cost. So a typical parking space is going to be $25,000 to build. And you add that to a monthly rent or to a mortgage, that's a hefty amount.
So rethinking how we view the needs.
Yeah. Plus, we have way too much surface parking in the city of Columbus. So I think we're good on that.
Yeah.
Front. Yeah. Well, I know that in some cases when multifamily housing is going in to be infill, there's a negotiation about that. There's not always – so that may be what the rules say, but there's probably a negotiation with the neighborhood and with the city about what they actually have to do. So there may be a variance based upon that.
Do people understand the equation of parking and what it means? Because when they talk about putting more housing in the Short North, people go, well, you know, where are we going to get the parking for all of that? Is there an educational piece of this that needs to be done outside of the college classroom?
Probably. Yeah. I think we're very attached to our cars here. And I think that it requires a different way of thinking about travel. So so Columbus has become a real magnet for young people, for millennials. And from what I understand, a lot of them don't want to drive. Right.
Right.
So who's going to live in those housings? Their transportation preferences may be different than the folks who are living here now. Or people who are empty nesters may decide that they want to move. A lot of them are buying housing in the Short North, right? They may decide they don't want to drive anymore, or they want to have one car instead of two. So, you know, our needs and family needs may be changing over time. It's hard to predict that sometimes, though. In the Short North, there's a parking garage. There are new parking garages going up in the Short North, too. So it's not like we're forgetting we have cars. It's just that we have a different way of dealing with them than we had with our previous land use pattern.
And it really matters also then where the jobs are. So downtown is still the largest job center in the region. But you talk about a lot of young people moving to Columbus. A lot of them are getting jobs at the fashion industry.
Way out in the New Albany.
Yeah,
New Albany, right.
New Albany. And then it's been great that Amazon has really invested in Central Ohio with more warehouses and jobs. But the Rickenbacker one, while it's accessible by transit, it's a very long ride. And then the one proposed for West Jeff and the one on the east side, you can't get to those by transit at all.
Yeah, and there's no housing. The one near Rickenbacker, there's no housing, really. Yeah.
Right.
That's very, very underdeveloped area.
So what's the appeal then to Amazon?
That's a good question.
Question for Amazon.
Yeah.
I think. Well, you think about it's a headquarters, right? So people are going to be living and working in a place, and so this region is a great place to live, right?
Yes.
If you have a job and you can afford to buy the housing you want, and it's a great place to raise a family, and it has a great variety of places. You can live in the country, you can live in the suburbs, you can live in the city, and we're all here. And it doesn't. I mean, a 20-minute commute for me across the city is nothing for someone who used to live in Seattle, which is where I used to live, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very attractive in those ways for a headquarters. the question is really for the folks we're talking about in the warehouses are not making that kind of money. And they're traveling probably a lot longer to work. I don't know how long they're traveling to work, actually. But we're talking about different populations and different segments of that industry who may be earning different amounts of money. Amazon has also been Amazon has also, expanded. It has a Amazon at Columbus here. We have Prime because we have a market here, too.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about affordable housing today and what that means. We keep saying affordable. It's a larger whole lifestyle issue that we have to look at on how we raise our families and how we live and who we live next door to. That's been something. This is one of the most segregated cities in the country. It has been for a long time. It was really highly affected by redlining in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And then when that went away, of course, in the 60s and 70s, they built the expressways and the outer belts and chopped up neighborhoods ad nauseum and destroyed them. Now they're trying to repair them and replace them. That's a lot harder than it looks. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rachel Cleet, you wanted to talk about place-based policies versus people-based policies.
Right. So a lot of time when we're talking, the conversation we've been having today about affordable housing has mostly been about building housing or creating housing, right, or repairing housing. So these neighborhoods that have housing that's deteriorating, we want to use housing as a way of revitalizing those neighborhoods and providing housing for people who want them in those places, right? But there, meanwhile, people live in neighborhoods and live in places where perhaps not all of them, people love their neighborhoods generally, but some people want to move and they can't because they don't have they can't afford the rental costs in other places. And so income is not a protected class under the Fair Housing Act. But there are lots of people who can't afford to make a choice about where they live. Or if they make that choice, they go without other things. And so one of the things we might want to be thinking about in this area is some sort of demand side subsidy, something that allows people to go into a marketplace and rent housing. Because if you even for people, the rental market. So we've been talking also about purchasing homes, right? I mean, I think that's the underlying conversation. Some of it's been about rental, but I think people when they think about housing generally think, okay, what do I pay for housing? How do I behave? I own a home. Can I afford to buy my home other places? And I'm making trade-offs off of neighborhoods in different places based upon what I can purchase. The rental market is also pretty. It can be very difficult. And the when you think about who can afford to rent a house, rent a place, there's a lot of rental housing available and there's affordable rental housing available, but it's not quality housing and it can be in neighborhoods that are not very safe. And there's no choices in terms of moving out of those places. So a demand side subsidy might be something that we want to consider.
I think Mary in North Linden might be asking about this. Hi, Mary, you're on the air. Hello, Mary.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
This subject is near to my heart. I am a college-educated white lady working in corporate America. I bought a home in North Linden 17 years ago because it's the only place I could afford. After living in Upper Arlington and Clintonville, rents were rising faster than my pay. Love my little house. Love the four or five houses around me. But living here has certainly opened my eyes to the struggle of families. I see people that are renting homes here that are wrecks. Okay, they're not a decent home. With three or four people in the house working, and they're trying to pay over $1,000 a month rent for this place. And I've driven around Columbus, and we have just so many neighborhoods that so many properties are just in terrible disrepair. And you'll see even in my neighborhood, you'll see five houses where everybody is working hard, just like me, to keep their property up. And then there's five of them on the block that are landlord-owned and just falling apart with grass a foot high.
What's your point? I mean, yes.
I have 2 points. One is I'm trapped in an unsafe area. There's gunshots every weekend.
Okay.
I can hear from my house. I would like to sell my house. I can sell my house. What I can't do is afford to rent an apartment in the city of Columbus without going into a worse neighborhood. Because I retire next year. I cannot afford $1,000 a month rent.
So this is exactly,
so that's number one. We need affordable apartments for people who are working or retired, who are not at the poverty level.
Because we do have the silver tsunami coming. Yeah.
The second of all, we need to do something through clamping down on landlords who are letting properties just, you know, deteriorate and blight our neighborhoods. And also, I know it's market and supply because I'm a business major, but how can we do something to ameliorate rents for people who are working? But
okay,
I don't know how.
All right, well let's talk about that. There's a lot of pieces there, but the landlord piece of it is something that should be addressed. And there is a big question about, they charge very high sums of money for rent. $1,000 a month is a lot. But they're doing it, they're charging it for dumps that they're not taking care of and they're not fixing up. Is there a moral obligation or is there a legal obligation? Is there any kind of obligation on the part of landlords to take care of properties?
I think the question is, so there's a dilemma here. So for landlords who are living in the city, it's different than people who are not, if you've like landlords living elsewhere or who are absentee. So people are living in the housing, it's occupied. And if you do code enforcement on the housing, then that housing gets taken off the market and those people don't have a place to live.
Right.
That's the issue, right? So you can certainly have code enforcement. I mean, I'm not from the city, but you could have violations marked and force someone to fix up their place. You could provide incentives for property owners to repair their units. If they repair their units, that rent is not going to stay the same unless you require it to stay the same. So there's a huge dilemma here about how we renovate rental units and keep them affordable when they're still on the market and the landlord has a lot of discretion about what they charge for rent. So I don't think there's a simple solution here. The question, there's always a demand and supply response to any kind of infusion of cash anywhere in the marketplace. And so the question is really, how do you anticipate what's going to happen and ameliorate the problem that's going to occur? So what's your goal? So if we renovate all the housing and don't try to maintain its affordability over time, then we're going to see even higher prices for housing in those areas. And the way you would do that is similar to what, so Community Development for All People did a homeownership initially and now is doing rental housing. And so they're buying rental housing and renovating it and they're going to be, that's their plan over the next few years, and maintaining it as affordable rental within the South End because of those kinds of dynamics in the market. So there are ways of creating long-term affordability that have to do with nonprofit ownership or community land trust ownership, and there are various ways of doing that for single-family fee simple housing as well. But again, that means we have to be very deliberate about what our goals are.
when we think about infusing money to do repairs, it's not as simple as that.
And we got to be able to make sure that long term really means long term. So the big example recently is the Metropolitan Housing Authority selling off Bollinger Tower in the Short North.
Right.
And if the Housing Authority isn't going to hang on to some of these units in the Short North, I don't know who is. And the Housing Authority, not to pick on them, so the Housing Authority shouldn't be put in that position. You know, they're going to be able to do three times the number of units by selling that property. But are those units going to be as accessible to jobs?
Library just turned down in January offers to renovate Grant Oak Apartments. They said it just wasn't in line with their vision for the property. But other people are thinking there's existing structures there. People are already living there.
So the Housing Authority is a very interesting case. So across the country, housing authorities are being asked to become more involved with the market. There's not a lot of support at the federal level for capital improvements for what we might think of as traditional public housing. And in fact, I would say that traditional public housing, as we know it, is going away. We're going to other kinds of structures for ownership of housing. So the Housing Authority is taking the money that it gets from these kinds of asset sales, because now we're asking housing authorities across the country to do act like private developers and do asset management. And decide which properties they should invest in, which properties they shouldn't, which ones they should sell, and what they should buy. And so CMHA is trying to think about, how do we do mixed income housing? How do we spread out our housing, which might be better for our region, right? So it's a set of market choices about how do you fulfill a mission. And they have the capacity to be a huge player in this mission. But it's very, you know, the Bollinger Tower example is a perfect example of that. How do we value this asset? Mm-hmm. Do we maintain a building for elderly people in a neighborhood where there is no housing for elderly people right now, otherwise, that we know of, right? Or do we sell it, and do they build 300 units of housing elsewhere? Or do they buy properties where they can do mixed income housing? Right. So they're thinking of a very long term affordability, because once they buy that housing and create it, that's going to be affordable forever, because that's their mission.
Mm-hmm. Not to pile onto Grant Oak Apartments, but that's a perfect example of naturally occurring affordable housing in the marketplace. And you know, I can't speak to what the vision for the property was that the library had, but you know, you're going to tear down existing units of affordable housing and build market rate apartments that are not affordable.
Market rate meaning there's the what people can afford to pay, mm-hmm. who can afford to pay it.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that speaks to why the city's new incentive structure, not to get into the details, but for the market ready neighborhoods like Short North, Harrison West, neighborhood north of Grandview, in order to qualify for those abatements, developers will have to contribute or set aside 20% of the units in that development at affordable rates, 10% at 80% of AMI and 10% at 100% AMI, which starts to tackle that missing middle.
Or they can donate money to funds. And we'll talk about that when we come back in just a minute. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the availability and development of affordable housing and what that means, more importantly. It's more than rent. It's more than mortgage. It's about accessibility. It's about affordability as far as rent. What are utilities cost? What about transportation? And because of that, we have the treasurer of Transit Columbus with us, Mark Conti. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks.
Also, director of planning, preservation, and development for the Ohio Housing Finance Agency, Kellen Craig. Thanks again, Kellen, for joining us. And a professor in regional planning at the Knowlton City and Regional Planning at the Knowlton School of Architecture at Ohio State, Rachel Cleet. Rachel, thanks again. We were just talking about these incentive programs that the city is considering for the different levels, the different kinds of ready for opportunity neighborhoods, ready for revitalization neighborhoods. They
they have projects. They'll qualify for different kinds of abatements depending on how many units of affordable housing they build. But in lieu of that, they can also donate to funds. And I'm wondering, what do you do with these funds if the housing isn't being built? What are the funds for?
The funds are usually given out by a city that does this kind of thing to nonprofits in the area or nonprofit developers of affordable housing to build affordable housing at the lower end.
What's the difference when you're building it at the lower end by a nonprofit? Is there any kind of value difference between that and when a regular developer built?
Yeah, there are some differences. Maybe Kellen could be more careful about this. But I think the differences would be, first of all, when a nonprofit is building affordable housing or providing affordable housing, their ownership, because they're a mission-driven organization, their ownership means that over the long run, they're going to work through their organization to maintain its affordability over time.
Okay.
The other thing is that if they end up owning it over the long run, they're very much interested in the quality of that place so that they don't have huge maintenance costs over time.
So they keep it up.
And so in some states, there's a requirement that all housing that gets state money is actually green and meets LEED standards.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times you'll find that affordable housing that gets built is much higher quality in terms of finishes and in terms of the utilities and the construction because they want it to last a very long time.
Hmm. But to get back to Mary's from Linden, I think Calden was asking about how to address housing issues there. I think for those neighborhoods that are market ready. And developers willing to set aside units, that's great. I think that's the primary goal of the city's new incentive program. But for the developers that don't want to do those units and are willing to contribute to, the Franklin, Columbus Housing Trust Fund,
mm-hmm.
We could use some of those funds to build in areas like Linden where a home may cost $150,000 to build, but the moment that they turn around and sell it to a low-income homebuyer, it's worth $60,000 because of the market. So there's that $90,000 gap there mm-hmm. that has to be filled somehow, and that's why a market-rate developer is not going to be willing to go there.
But if we do that, we also want to make sure that we think about, over the long run, we're anticipating in this region an influx of people, and in the best world, what we're trying to do with this housing is improve neighborhoods as well as improve people's lives.
So the people spend in their neighborhoods,
right.
They live in their neighborhoods.
So what we want to try to do is, if you're going to invest money in a property as a public sector organization, you want to ensure that that has a long-term effect on a place and that there's no windfall profit on the seller of that property. So sometimes what we've been doing mostly locally with that kind of a mindset is having a pretty short run affordability demand. So if you sell it in the first 2 years or something, it's still affordable. But if you are able to invest that initial capital, and then on sale, the person may get a percent of a capital increase, right?
Okay.
The price might go up. And the rest of that profit might be not taken. It might just go into making that property affordable to the next homeowner.
Okay.
Over time. Then that would be how a community land trust would work. And that's how in a Yellow Springs, that's how the community land trust works. So the idea would be to make that it's much more efficient and much less expensive to make that use that that initial infusion of subsidy to create long-term affordability than to re-subsidize a unit
right.
over and over
right.
again.
So that means, all right, I'm going to benefit. I'm going to buy a low-income house. I'm going to have an opportunity to buy in a low-income area, buy a new house.
Right.
I buy it at a lower cost.
Right.
And then I sell it. I don't get all that profit back.
No.
That part of the profit goes back into the trust.
Right.
Okay. Gotcha.
Right.
I don't know.
Can I just add one other thing?
Yeah.
So in Yellow Springs, it's not like people live in these houses forever.
Mm-hmm.
They sell them and then they move into regular market housing. Right. So it's not like this is a dead end.
Right.
It's a way of people beginning to grow some capital so that they can move into the market.
Mm-hmm. Carol in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. I am enjoying the conversation this morning, although I'm quite frustrated. Here's what I see, being a longtime resident of the Short North. We have pretty much lost the low-income, middle-income bracket in this area, and I don't look for it ever to come back. Mm-hmm. Look what we have. Look what we have approved. We have high-income apartment building up on campus, $1,000, $1,200, $1,500, $950 a month for students who are passing through. On the other end down here, we have the same thing, jamming in apartment units as much as they can, $1,000 and up rent. People that don't want responsibilities for the house, they may be here for a while working at their home on their computer, then they're gone, business is coming in, business is leaving. We're not going to have our neighborhood anymore, not the one that we have had with families, children, pets, etc. It just isn't going to be. So you can talk to as many big-time developers as you like and get them to give you some money for all of these other projects that aren't going to happen. We don't have rent subsidies. We don't have any way to regulate rents. The investment real estate market has been totally out of control for some years now, quite a few years now. They've gotten everything they want, including people that have high incomes and high-paying apartments, and they've got tax abatements. Now, what the hell is this?
Well, it sounds – well, now, Carol, I understand. I mean, we understand what you're talking about. It sounds like that's coming to an end. I mean, that they're not going to – they're being more discriminating about the tax abatements. They're spreading around the city more. Who wants to take on Carol?
Well,
Carol's angry. I mean, I hear it, and
I think what the city is doing is a really big step they're taking in realigning where these abatements are going to go and what neighborhoods they're going to target. But the other thing I would say is Columbus is not the only game in town. We have other municipalities and we have other job centers that aren't within the city limits. Is it reasonable to expect everybody can live within a 5-minute walk of where they work? Probably not. Mm-hmm. But when you think about the office parks stretching around the north outer belt from Dublin over to Westerville, are the service workers at those hotels, at those restaurants, people who are working entry-level jobs even within city governments of those suburbs, are they even able to afford to live anywhere in those cities? That's another question we need to be asking.
And I also would say in some metropolitan areas, there are actually tenants' unions where tenants gather together and they lobby for more laws that would protect their rights. Right now, our tenants in this area do not have very strong rights.
Well, Carol mentioned an issue, which is transients, people moving in and out. That's part of this big city scenario we're looking at in the future.
Yet our population continues to grow, so I'm not sure how many are still moving out overall. And you know, I live in the Short North. I'm a 21-year resident of the Short North. I started living there as a renter and eventually bought. People have different trajectories in their careers and their lives, and they move into the city, they move out, but a lot of people are sticking around. And I think overall the big takeaway really for everybody is if we really are going to get 1 million people by 2050, how do we get ahead of that? And we're still trying to make up ground, lost ground from the recession. Our home building isn't keeping up with our population increases, and that, barring anything else, is driving
up rent.
The apartment
building, I mean, it feels like it's been an explosion.
If they weren't filling up, the rents wouldn't be so high.
Yeah. And to piggyback off of Mark, I'd say a month and a half ago, Business First hosted a power breakfast, and one of the Schottensteins, their single-family development company, got up and spoke about needing a true regional approach. And, you know, our, you know, suburban communities, the Dublins, Worthingtons of the world, have a responsibility as well to change their zoning laws to allow more than one single family home per acre so that there's more affordable housing supply across the board. You know, if you have one home per acre and, you know, are not following through on increasing density and so forth, I think the problem's going to continue and can't be borne solely by the city of Columbus.
So much of it is about changing attitudes about where we live. And I live in Worthington, and I know that what you're talking about, there's just immediately people are up in arms about multi-unit housing, but there's a demand for it. People want it, and they don't care if there's parking there. But they think it changes the tenor, the feel of the neighborhood.
Yeah, and you think about a community where there might not be any type of multifamily housing, even for that's completely market rate and meant for people who make a lot of money. If you're in a home and you're deciding, oh, we're empty nesters now, we want to retire, we want to downsize, but we want to stay in our community, that should be an option for you as well.
And there's really very few options in a lot of the suburban communities.
Yeah, I'll
to do
say
that.
It again. The silver tsunami is coming. Yeah. Where is everybody going to live? Not only because they want more accessible housing, easier places to live. They don't want to move from their neighborhoods. And they're going to be going into fixed income territory and aren't going to be able to afford.
And then that frees up the single family homes right. in those neighborhoods for new families.
Alan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Alan.
Yeah, quick. I'm a investor and also a realtor. And if my tenants would get their credit score above a 640, they could save $250 to $300 by buying almost the same house they're living in. But they don't. And half of them don't even have a checking account. So some of this has got to be put back on training people to pay their bills on time.
Well, yeah, that goes back to the shelter poverty problem, right? That we had, that we talked about way back in the beginning of today, that, so there are barriers certainly to moving into better housing, right? So credit scores bad credit that results from unpaid debts, right? A lot of people are facing that. That's why they're living in that housing mm-hmm. and paying more. That's true. There are also people who are unbanked and
an increasing problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, that a traditional bank doesn't serve them because they need much smaller, outputs of money, and so they go to payday lenders, which is serving a very particular service for a very particular part of the population. Mm-hmm. And in some parts of the country, they have low-income credit unions to deal with these kinds of problems. So that these credit unions are mobile. They go into the neighborhood with a laptop, and they're there for a little bit, and they serve their clients. And credit unions, you can go to any credit union ATM in the country. Because there's a network, so there certainly are things we can do that can be done on the financial side for people who are in that situation. But the question is, how do you do that in a very deliberate way, and how do you do that in a way that's going to be long lasting, and it's not like I would say the poorer you are, actually the more discipline you probably have about how you spend money because you have less of it. So. The reasons people might be having problems with their credit scores are many. A lot of them are actually educational debt.
Educational debt, healthcare debt.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
And there's a model that I'd love to see replicated. It's a development that we funded in Columbus, but Residences at Career Gateway on the south side. It's a partnership between NRP Group out of Cleveland, Community Development for All People, and as a partnership with Nationwide Children's Hospital. They have a large job training center on site. They have personal financial classes on site, but the training on site is provided by Nationwide for jobs that are in their system. And the goal, of course, is for these families that are households that are at 60% AMI and below to get the skills necessary to maintain a steady job and hopefully move up and out of poverty and out of the tax credit development and into, a home ownership opportunity.
Like Alan in Clintonville mm-hmm. is suggesting. We're out of time. I want to but we're not out of conversation because this conversation is ongoing. I want to thank you, Kellen Craig, for joining us today. For what we have done. Director of Planning, Preservation, and Development up for the Ohio Housing Finance Agency. Also, Rachel Cleet, professor in City and Regional Planning at the Knowlton School of Architecture at Ohio State. Thank you. Thanks to you.
My pleasure.
And also Mark Conti, Treasurer of Transit Columbus. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.